This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Magazines like National Geographic are adapted for the blind at an institution right here in Cincinnati. Clover Nook also reproduces the menu at McDonald's, but some data indicate that Braille use is on the decline. Let's talk about it. Joining me now is the manager of the Braille Printing House at Clover Nook Center, Sam Fuchs. He's in the studio. Welcome, Sam.
Hi.
We also have David Grimes. He's the Quality Assurance Coordinator at the Braille Printing House at Clover Nook. Welcome, David.
Hi. Nice to be here.
And a little bit later, we're going to be talking with Mackenzie Love. She's a student out of the Columbus area and a Braille Challenge National Competition participant. We'll get her on the phone and talk about her experience in the local competition, which was hosted at Clover Nook. And then she went on to the big time national competition, and we'll talk to her about how that went down. So first, Sam, let's talk about how young people who are competing in these events, how do they start to learn Braille? When does that process start?
So typically at a very young age, there's a professional role in that process, teaches the visually impaired TVIs, work with students, teach them the Braille basics, so your alphabet. There are two different kinds of Braille. So there's grade one Braille, which is essentially your basic alphabet. So when you're in preschool, kindergarten, you'd start to learn that basic A through Z. The common Braille, which is referred to as grade two Braille, is full of contractions. It's kind of like secretarial shorthand. So the is its own symbol. TH is its own symbol. Common words, letters. So typically, as a student progresses through elementary school, middle school, they're learning all of these contractions. So by the time you get to Mackenzie's age, you should be fluent in all these different aspects of the code.
And I believe Mackenzie's about 16 years old. So
yes.
Right about high school age, you're pretty competent. David, what was your experience like in learning that language?
My experience was I started in kindergarten, probably in preschool maybe even, but I remember in kindergarten is when you really start, and the first thing you learn about, you learn what the Braille writer is, and you learn A is your first letter, of course, and you learn how to make a row of those. And I also saw a book that they use in preschool now. I saw it a few years back. It starts out with one page having like a big square, say, or a big circle on one page. You feel that, and then as you progress, you go to a line of two circles, like big circles, and then the next page would have a line of three big circles, so you get the concept of reading from left to right. And then as you go further, the circles get smaller and smaller until you have like a line of like 8 or 10. And then after that, they'll start putting dots in a line, and then you start to get the concept of going from left to right with your fingers. And so then I don't remember a lot about learning it. It's just one of those things that you just learn, just I guess like a sighted person would. It's the same concept, I think, except you just use your fingers to read, as I tell people. I read with my fingers just like you read with your eyes. So,
and we should note that Sam here in the studio is a sighted person. And David, are you considered blind?
Yes, I am. Okay. Totally blind, yes.
And you work at a place called Clover Nook, and you are on the publishing side. So there's something really interesting about books that are published in Braille because they're huge, right? They're a lot bigger than the books that sighted people might pick up at a Barnes & Noble or something.
Yes.
Yeah, they can be gigantic. So if anyone ever comes out to Clover Nook, I can show them a 1972 Webster's Dictionary in Braille that takes up an entire wall.
Wow.
It's in 79 volumes.
So what makes it so long? Is it just because of the number of characters that are used in creating the alphabet?
It's space. So typically a print page of a novel would be about 3 pages in Braille. Braille pages aren't as compact as print pages just due to the tactile nature of the text itself. So you can typically only have about 150 to 200 pages in each volume. Otherwise, you risk damaging the Braille dots.
So what kind of work are you doing in the printing house? And is this where materials are being produced?
Yes. So we produce a variety of different publications, books, magazines, menus. Our primary work is for the Library of Congress, the National Library Service. So they provide free books and magazines to patrons across the United States. So we produce the Braille versions of Rolling Stone, National Geographic, ESPN, We used to do Playboy back in the day. So, you know, I think people who read the Braille version of Playboy could say they're actually reading it for the articles.
You told that joke before.
Yes, yes, they could, because there's no pictures.
Yeah.
Well, David, you're the quality assurance guy.
Yeah.
So are you the one checking the syntax and the grammar and the spelling?
Yes, in the books. That's part of my job. I have a certain list of things that I go through and look for when I get books back, and I keep track of what I find. And I also keep track of what other people in the department are reading. So I'm in charge of keeping I call it a reader log. For each book, I'll say so-and-so took volume one and read through page 50, per se. And so then if someone else picks it up, I'll say so-and-so picked up volume one starting on page 51. And so my responsibilities are to go through the books when they come to me, and then I go through and check them. And I also correct what people have read in the books. They'll keep a Braille error log, and that comes back to me, then I correct that.
So how did you all land this responsibility of dealing with these high-profile national magazines?
It's something that Klovnik's been doing for a very long time. So it's under contract with the National Library Service. So we produce about 15 different magazine titles and then around 100 books a year for the Library Service. So we've been doing that for the past 60 years or so. We've been producing Braille since 1914, which is so long ago, actually, that when we first started producing, we didn't produce Braille. We produced a different form of tactile writing called New York Point that was more common.
What was the difference?
New York Point is actually a four-dot system. It was common in the early 20th century. And then about the 1920s, you saw most institutions utilizing Braille.
What prompted that change?
A realization amongst different organizations and countries that it was unwieldy to have these different competing systems.
We can't quite get there on the metric system yet, though, can we?
No, not yet.
A little bit stubborn about that. We do have Mackenzie on the line. Let's bring her in. Mackenzie is a 16-year-old student out of the Columbus area who competed in a national competition about Braille. And Mackenzie, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so glad you could join us. How did you do at the national competition?
I didn't end up placing this year, but this is my first year ever going. I'm going to try again.
Well, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how the competition works. What are the events like?
Well, on Friday, we just kind of like got to know one another. And then Saturday is the actual Braille Challenge competition. And then Saturday evening, you have the awards banquet.
Awesome. So, like, what exactly are you competing in? What are some of the activities that you're doing and that you're trying to do better than your peers?
Reading comprehension, speed and accuracy, proofreading, and chart and graph.
Oh, cool. Which one's your best event?
I feel like proofreading is my best area.
And you competed here locally. You and another student qualified out of Ohio after competing at Klovernook. Was that the first time that you had competed, or have you been doing this for a while?
That was my third time that I competed at Klovernook, my first time to go out to Los Angeles.
So what was Los Angeles like for you?
It was very busy, and it was my first time, so it was very interesting. We did some sightseeing out there.
Very cool. And you said you didn't place, but I think everybody's still probably very proud of you for making it out there and getting to compete at the national level. And I think you broke up just a little bit, but did you say you were going to give it a shot again next year?
I'm hoping to.
So how will you practice to qualify a little bit better next time?
There are sample contests out from the past years that they've done it.
Well, we'll be rooting for you then. Mackenzie, thanks so much for your time, and good luck to you next year in the Braille competition.
Thank you.
So, Sam, tell us about these competitions. Klovernook hosts one, and, you know, what goes down at them? Like a lot of competitors?
Yes, quite a few competitors, and I think Mackenzie was understating the greatness of her achievement in making it to nationals. Yeah. It's really hard to get to that stage. So the Braille Challenge is a national competition that has regional heats, if you will. And Klovenuk hosts the Ohio Regional Heat. So we have students come from all over Ohio to come and compete at various age levels in all these different aspects of Braille reading skills. So you have your Braille reading and comprehension, speed and accuracy, spelling, proofreading, tactile graphics, map reading, all those things that Mackenzie was mentioning. And the top 10 in each age group nationally go out to California, and you've got thousands of kids across the U.S. competing. So Mackenzie, even just by going out there, is in the top 10 in her age group nationally,
wow,
which is huge.
Yeah, that is pretty huge. Now, we've been talking about the adoption of the Braille system. You said around the 1920s is when most places converted to that from New York Point to the previous?
New York Point was what we used, but there were other systems beside that.
Okay, before it became more universal to use Braille. But I understand that there's kind of a decline in the use of it now. Was I reading that data incorrectly? It looked like at one point in the middle of the 20th century, it was reported that half of all blind people could use Braille. Now it's around 10%. Is that accurate?
Different people will give you different answers about that. That's actually quite a... I wouldn't quite say controversial, but it's under dispute in some areas, that statistic. Some of the actual data sets that these studies have used haven't really quantified blindness very effectively. So people who are low vision might be able to read the print documents that are in front of us right here with a magnifier, so they're not going to be learning Braille. But I do think that there is a trend. If it's not 10%, it is still lower than I would say it was in the 1950s, 1960s.
And what's causing that?
I can go into that if you want, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure, like that.
A lot of it is technology. There is so much audio technology available that it's easier to read, just pick up a book on an audio and read it. You can download books everywhere. But the downside to audio is you don't learn sentence structure, you don't learn spelling, you don't learn to read. It's one of those pet peeves with me, although I do use audio quite a bit when I'm at home because I work with Braille all day. But I still do read like my Braille Bible and things like that. So it's just one of those things that it's easier to learn audio, but it's not really helpful if you want to be literate. You can't write a note to somebody. You can't keep a private journal. I mean, you could with a tape recorder or your phone or whatever. You could do an audio, but it's not the same as just being able to write something like at a spur of the moment. If you want to write someone's phone number or you want to write down, oh, I need to go to the store and get this, just to jot yourself a little note. I think it's important that Braille be an option to everybody who needs it. You know, for me, who has been reading it my whole life, I would definitely would say that it needs to be out there. It needs to be for everybody who could use it.
I saw a 2009 publication from the National Federation for the Blind calling the decline in Braille a crisis. It noted, quote, each year as many as 75,000 people lose all or part of their vision. And as the baby boom generation moves into retirement age and as diabetes approaches epidemic proportions, the NFB expects this number to increase dramatically. And if nothing is done, the Braille illiteracy rate will as well. So I'm curious about the impact that this could have on people who can see now but may lose their vision sometime down the road due to an illness or aging or any number of reasons and to not have this language tool available. Is that a consideration in the world of blind assistance?
Yes, it is. Klovenuk has actually run Braille workshops for older adults who are losing their vision, who are low vision. And it is very possible to learn Braille later in life. But like learning any language, it's you've got to stick with it and you've got to practice. It's not something that comes easy. And especially with something like Braille, it's very different than learning something vocally. It's learning a whole new system of interpreting data. But it is very possible.
Well, has this decline in Braille, purported or otherwise, had any type of impact on what you do in the publishing component at Klovenuk?
Well, the decline in Braille has impacted us in terms of the number of copies of magazines that we are producing. We produce a little over 20 million pages of Braille a year. back in the 1950s, 60s, you're looking at maybe 50, 60 million pages of Braille. But we're not seeing less people reading on materials. What we're seeing is more people accessing on materials digitally, because with the rise of technology and the threats from, say, audio also come opportunities. So there's a lot of technology out there now that is essentially representing, we call it refreshable Braille, the digital displays that essentially display live Braille text, translating files online. So you can access all magazines online and read them on your own personal Braille display with a live Braille feed.
But you still have to be able to be literate to do that. So
yeah, you still have to learn Braille, but it's we're seeing a shift from hard copy due to the bulkiness to digital access.
Mm-hmm. And David, I understand you have a Braille watch.
Yes, I do. It has a 4-cell display and it pairs with my phone, so I can check text messages from my phone on there. I can make a call from there if I wanted to. And it can also do it in different languages.
So what other technological components are you now able to use because of these advancements?
As Sam said, they have the refreshable Braille displays that go from anywhere from 4 cells up to 40. The ones we use at work are 40-cell Braille displays because your standard Braille for the Library of Congress is 40 cells, 25 lines per page. And that's another reason why that Braille is so bulky, because we use 11.5 by 11 Braille paper. And so it's kind of bulky. So that's why that the shift is coming. You can even have Braille displays that hook up to your phone that pair with your phone through Bluetooth. And you can read your phone that way. They're like 16, 14 cells. And what I refer to as a Braille cell is, think of the number 6 on a dice. Those 6 dots, that's what your Braille cell looks like. You have 1, 2, 3 on the left and 4, 5, 6 on the right. So everything in Braille is composed of different patterns of those cells.
David, what do you think are some common misconceptions that people have about the blind?
Oh, goodness. Some people think that if you're blind, well, you're also deaf, so they talk real loud to you.
Oh, see, I thought it was the opposite, that people assume that blind people had better hearing.
Some people do, but they also assume that you can't hear at all.
Okay.
Or if you're with someone who's sighted, they will look to that person and say, what does he want? That's one of my pet peeves.
Yeah.
I don't like that at all. And my wife always says, I don't know, ask him. You know, she just puts it back on them. And it's just interesting. Some people do think that blind people can hear better. I don't really know if I believe that. My wife thinks I do, but I think we're more attuned to it because we don't have our eyes to fall back on. So you are more attuned to your hearing. I've freaked out people. They come into a room and don't say a word, and I know who they are. And they're like, how'd you know it was me?
Whoa. Well, how do you know?
Well, my one nephew, he breathes kind of heavy, so I know that's him. I was like, hi, Ralph. And he's like, how'd you know that's me? I didn't say anything. It's like, because of your breathing. So, you know, and sometimes you can get good at knowing people's walk, you know, their steps, and just different things like that. It's just different tricks to the trade, I guess.
That's very interesting.
Yep.
And what are you guys working on currently? I understand maybe the Grapes of Wrath is involved in some of the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, so we do about 100 different books a year. It's actually, I think, my favorite time of the week. We get a big box full of books, and we don't know what's in it until we open up. So it's usually about 2 or 3 titles selected by the Library of Congress. And at the moment, Grapes of Wrath is in the proofreading phase. It's going to be 9 volumes, and it's not surprisingly the most popular assignment right now, because with a book that big, you have to split it up amongst different teams. So imagine just having to read, you know, the middle 100 pages of Grapes of Wrath out loud for 8 hours. You know, it's not necessarily the most popular assignment right now.
Well, when you're going through some of these stories, and if there are images that are important to the storytelling, how do you handle graphics?
That's a good question. So typically in magazines, so say National Geographic, there'll be images with captions, and we'll insert the captions if they have a meaning past just the image, if it's importing any sort of information. If you're doing something that's a little more permanent and not just a monthly magazine, you can actually produce tactile graphics to replicate the image. And so by tactile graphic, I'm referring to essentially a system of raised lines and textures and Braille that communicate the image through a raised representation.
I've been speaking with the manager for the Braille Printing House at Clover Nook Center, Sam Fuchs, and the quality assurance coordinator at the Braille Printing House at Clover Nook, David Grimes. I appreciate you both coming in and talking to us today about this. Very fascinating.
Thank you so much
for having us.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.